Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. At its founding, it hoped to attract what JFK called America's best resource. 55 years later, the Peace Corps is still attracting young volunteers and controversy over their safety. Peace Corps Director Carrie Hessler-Radlett looks at the program's challenges and its future. And news analyst Neil Conan takes a look at a couple of primaries and the implications of the outcome of the presidential race in the Philippines.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Peter Shaffer's play Equus takes the audience into unknown territory, the workings of a troubled mind. We'll talk with the director of the new Manoa Valley Theater production. And we'll meet Hawaii's new English-speaking union, National Shakespeare Competition champ, Ari Dalbert.
It's Tuesday, May 17th. Stay here for the conversation coming up after this news.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
I was just thinking of that very JFK quotation.
Because we're going to talk about the Peace Corps
exactly.
This morning? Exactly. Well, you know, that's a long legacy, and we're going to take a look at how it's developed over recent years in particular.
Yeah, 55 years, yeah.
55 years.
Yikes.
And you know, in Hawaii, there are more of them than there have been in the past 4 years. And while maybe 29 might not seem a huge number to you, to the Peace Corps, the current upswing of the volunteers who live in our state are part of a national trend the program hopes will continue. In its 55-year history, as Chris mentioned, the Peace Corps has sent over 1,400 Hawaii residents to remote places to build relationships as much as livable communities. In recent years, there's also been controversy over the safety of Peace Corps volunteers. We spoke with Director Carrie Hessler-Radlett in advance of her visit to Hawaii later this week. I asked her about whether modern volunteers are still what JFK called America's best resource.
Absolutely. I think so. And in fact, that is reinforced every time I travel overseas and meet our community members who work side by side with our volunteers. When I speak to our own ambassadors, they say that Peace Corps volunteers are our best ambassadors at the community level. And they are fantastic representatives of their host nations back here in the United States.
Over 220,000 of them have come through the program from 1961 through at least last year, including you and four generations of your family, which means you have a perhaps different perspective than others who might be in your position would have. What has changed in the way that you've seen the program develop and change over the years in terms of the kind of people that were once attracted to the Peace Corps and the kind that you hope are attracted to the Peace Corps now?
Thank you. We are the only four-generation Peace Corps family. And just to be clear how that happened, my aunt was a volunteer in Turkey in the mid-60s. My grandparents served in the early 70s after they retired. They were themselves 68 years old when they went in. My husband and I served in the early 80s, and then my nephew served from 2007 to 2009 in Mozambique. So it has really been a family affair for us. But Peace Corps has evolved over the years. The world has changed, and so we needed also to be responsive to the needs of our host nations. And there are a couple of changes that I really would love to highlight. First of all is our focus on better supporting volunteers. When I was a volunteer in the early 80s, it was not uncommon for volunteers to be out and about for as much as 6 months without ever touching base with our country offices, and that is just simply not the case now. Our volunteers are very networked with their fellow volunteers, with our staff in country, and with other development partners, too. Technology has made that possible, but also the expectation that they are working as part of a larger development community, and our volunteers are actively working to help our partner nations achieve their development goals. And so they are not working alone. They are working in partnership with others, and they are highly networked. So that's one big change. The second is, as I mentioned earlier, the support to volunteers. We've been focusing extensively on safety and security and medical care for our volunteers. We want our volunteers to be absolutely certain that we're there for them when they have needs, especially safety and security and medical needs. In addition, we've really stepped up our technical training and program support so they can be effective at their job.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the safety issues and the medical issues. Last fall, we saw a report that was an internal report that said that 1 in 5 volunteers could be sexually assaulted during the time of their service. What's happened in the last 7 months to be able to stem that, and was there a final report ever issued?
You know, we monitor and evaluate our program on a regular basis, really monthly. Right now, our Office of Inspector General is conducting an evaluation of our program, so that's a very formal evaluation that will inform our progress going forward. But let me just start by saying that there's nothing more important to this agency than the health and safety of our volunteers. There's no issue that we care about more or that I personally spend more time on. And as part of our sexual assault risk response and risk reduction and response program, we have made over 30 policy changes. We have hired a new cadre of staff. I mean, we have made a fundamental change in the way we support our volunteers writ large, but especially in the area of safety and security. So we are constantly monitoring our progress to make sure that we are making adjustments as we go forward to improve the quality of our support to volunteers. We have recently trained all of our medical officers who are the primary responders through continuing medical education. That is ongoing. It happens once a year anyway, but you know, a lot of our training focuses on sexual assault response for primary responders. In the last 7 months, we've really been focusing on risk reduction, so improving the quality of our pre-service training for volunteers so that they have the tools to enable themselves to identify risks in their community, to have the language skills that they need to navigate difficult cultural issues, and to be able to respond by helping each other when they identify that there are risks of sexual assault or any kind of crime. So the whole risk reduction training has been a huge focus in the last year.
The Peace Corps was funded in the last budget. Do you have any concerns about its funding going forward?
You know, we work very closely with Congress, and we are grateful for the bipartisan support that we have from Congress. You know, I go up there very frequently, so I don't have concerns per se. We believe that we're very good value for money for the U.S. government, and so we are continuing to reinforce that message with both supporters and others, but we enjoy very good relations with Congress.
And the relevance of the Peace Corps today in terms of what projects you focus on, how is that changing in response to a world that seems to be ever more dangerous?
You know, the honest truth is that research shows that the world is a quantifiably more peaceful place now than it was even 10 years ago. So, but that's not a fact that is covered very frequently in the news, I have to say. That is not to say that the world is not a dangerous place. There are certainly risks that are evident everywhere, and there are different kinds of risks in Peace Corps countries. So, you know, that's why it's so important that we continue to monitor our programs and our training and our response so that we can provide the kind of support that our volunteers need. But I also feel that Peace Corps needs to continue to evolve as the world changes. So that means that we need to be looking at important development issues as they evolve, such as climate change, such as the youth bulge. All of these issues, which are of critical importance to our partner nations, we need to make sure that we're equipping our volunteers with the knowledge and skills that will enable them to make an effective difference at the community level.
And anything that you think that the Peace Corps once did that just no longer has relevance? I've noticed some programs drop out, but anything that you see now that you might change?
Well, you know, we've identified that our real strong niche is at the community level. Throughout our history, we have had volunteers living in urban areas, working in large cities, and while we do still have some programs where volunteers are living in and working in large cities, by and large, our sweet spot is in rural communities. We focus very strongly on building capacity, so no longer are volunteers building bridges or digging wells. We are working side by side with communities to help them build capacity to achieve their own development goals. So those are two changes that happen. have taken place over the years.
And as you come to Hawaii, what is your concise message to folks in our part of the world?
Well, first of all, I'm so excited to be visiting Hawaii. I have three goals from my visit there. First is a recruitment goal. In particular, we're interested in diversity recruitment. We have a huge commitment to ensuring that our volunteer force represents the beautiful diversity of our nation. And so we are really interested in making sure that Native Hawaiians and residents of Hawaii are aware of Peace Corps and understand the benefits of Peace Corps service to them and to our nation. So the recruitment part is a very big part of it. Secondly, we really are going to be thanking our university partners. We have had strong partnerships with the University of Hawaii, both in Manoa and Hilo, over the last 55 years since we have been in operation, and so it's an opportunity for us to thank our university partners. And then in addition, I want to thank our return volunteers for their continued service. We have a very active group of return volunteers, and they continue to serve their community in Hawaii and beyond.
Thank you very much for the time that you were able to spend with us this morning, and have a safe trip.
Thank you so much.
Carrie Hessler-Radlett is the 19th director of the Peace Corps. She's led historic reforms to modernize and strengthen the program, including efforts to revitalize volunteer recruitment and the application selection process that resulted in record-breaking application numbers last year. She'll be in Honolulu this Friday as part of the Peace Corps' 55th year and will speak at a free public event at the East-West Center. Details are on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Rooms, River View.
How do we generate enough housing supply to accommodate all the people we want to live here or who want to live here?
The boom in high-end, high-rise real estate and the ground-level boom in homelessness in America. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
It's now 8:17, and you're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. Coming up, an onstage look at the world of the mentally ill. Now, your backyard quiz.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a Caribbean island that shares a number of similarities with Hawaii. Our mystery isle lies in the leeward chain of the Lesser Antilles Archipelago. Like Hawaii, it was formed as a result of volcanic activity, a volcano that remains active today. This Caribbean sister island has even had the destruction of cities and towns at the hands of its volcano, as we've had here in Hawaii. But the similarities don't end there. The island in question shares ancestry with Hawaii. It's currently a territory of the United Kingdom, whereas Hawaii was once a protectorate of the British Empire. To truly solidify the connection, there's even a street in Honolulu with a very similar-sounding name. If you can be the first one to tell us the name of this distant relation, you'll be today's winner. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school for boys and girls in preschool through grade 12, with classes in digital media, art, robotics, and more. Full course listings at sacredhearts.org.
The roots of severe mental illness go deep, and the effort of a therapist can be compared to that of a detective working from fitfully provided clues to construct a coherent narrative. The dramatic momentum of the play Equus, a meditation on religion, sexuality, and the workings of a troubled mind, comes from that effort as a psychiatrist in a mental hospital struggles to reach a troubled young man who is fixated on horses. Alex Monroe is the director of a new Manoa Valley Theater production that opens this week. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
You know, I just was thinking about the term mental illness, and in a way that's a little bit deceptive because with the kind of illness that we're talking about in this play, there's a feeling almost that this is not necessarily it's not disoriented. It might be a different view of reality that can educate us, you know?
Yeah, and I think also it asks the question of, you know, Dysart has this question to the audience time and time again, is this boy even really sick?
Yeah.
Is this treatment that I'm going to do for him actually going to help him, or is it going to make him worse off?
And that has come up in a couple of plays about mental illness. I'm also thinking about Cuckoo's Nest, which where we started looking at mental illness differently and maybe thinking, are we, you know, tormenting people who might be on to something?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a theme that we really tried to wrestle with our production, and also as a way to sort of connect it to an audience here in Honolulu in 2016, because it is a play that was written in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And we didn't want it to be sort of a museum piece.
Right.
And so we really are wrestling with this idea of a conflict between, you know, nature versus modernity, but also this idea of lived experience. This boy, Alan, who we are describing as mentally ill in the play, has this connection to a god that he has created through these horses.
Mm-hmm.
And Dysart, in treating him, comes to realize that he envies this boy, that he can go out and touch this god. And all Dysart can do is just flip through pages of these Greek gods and touch his reproduction statue of Dionysus.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have that connection. So yeah, I think maybe he thinks that Alan is onto something.
And Dysart longs to have that kind of connection. You can see that in his fascination with the ancient gods, yeah?
Absolutely. And we've tried to sort of show that that through treating Alan, he starts to not just to experience Alan's religion vicariously, but also, you know, actually sees Equus. You know, we start Act Two with Dysart actually confronting Equus, the god, himself.
Well, you know, it's easy for the many of the unbeliever wishes he were a believer, envies the believer that security, that solidity of having something to believe in. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think even with Dysart, it's more than that. It's, you know, there's this one of my favorite scenes in the entire production. Alan and Dysart are just sharing a cigarette and they're sort of sharing these secrets. And Dysart talks about how he would love to go to this town. It's where the gods used to go to bathe. And Alan says, oh, what gods? And he says, the old ones before they died. And Alan says, gods don't die. And Dysart looks at him and says, yes, they do.
Mm.
And what he's saying really is, I'm going to kill your god through treating you.
Yeah. And, of course, this was written, placing it in its time, this was written in the God is Dead era,
right?
When that was, you know, commonly said, when it was said in the post-war world, post-Second World War world, had lost its connection to spirituality. And, of course, we're, you know, quite a few years down the line from then. I'm not sure where we are in that continuum. Are you?
No, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that, you know, some of those themes that, you know, like you said, written in the 60s, late 70s, still resonate today. And not just with religion, but, you know, Dora, the mom, Alan's mom, has this monologue where she's basically saying, you know, you came into my house and you accused me of how I raised my son. And I feel like, you know, that's become even more relevant today in a time where we have all these mass shootings.
Yeah.
And we ask these questions about how these children were raised and were video games involved or television, Game of Thrones and Grand Theft Auto. So I think he was really sort of prophetic in his writing.
Yeah. In those days, a troubled youth was was a juvenile delinquent. He might get in trouble with the cops. He wasn't going to massacre people in a shopping mall.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's a big difference, isn't it?
Yeah, to see how times have changed in that regards.
What steps did you take to keep it from being a revival museum piece?
Like I said, we went back to the play and I tried to find themes that I thought would resonate with an audience here in Honolulu in 2016, and so that the conflict between nature versus modernity, I think that's something that would resonate with us. You know, the conversations we have over rail and Mauna Kea observatories, mm-hmm. but also this lack of actual lived experience. Dysart, like I said, Dysart looks through pages of these books, but he doesn't actually have his own god, and Alan does.
Yeah.
And so we try to show that with the use of television sets. So the television is something that comes throughout the whole script. Alan's not allowed to watch TV. He sneaks off. His mom lets him sneak off and watch westerns. Mm-hmm. He watches TV when he's at the hospital. And so I spent the past 15 months combing the streets of Honolulu on bulk pickup day and picking up these television sets. And then the designers have really helped me make sure that we can use them to show video into a really sort of visceral effect for the audience.
And, of course, a young man who has made a connection to his own kind of godhead mm-hmm. he's not a victim of the technological world. He's found something deeper than that, right?
Right. Yeah. And so it's kind of flip, right? Because now we look at the millennials, and you know, there's always those memes on Facebook where they say, "Well, back in my day, I was out, looking at playing in the woods or by the creek." And then now you look at today's youth, and they're stuck in cell phones and iPads, and it's flipped, right? Like Alan's out there touching his god, and it's Dysart with the artificial.
So, one has a connection to something that the other deeply wants, but it's not who you think.
Absolutely. And it's something that we wrestle with the entire play. And I'm really hoping that when people leave the show, that they really start to they ask themselves, like, did he do the right thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And really, who is the one that's sick?
That's the subtext of any really good play about mental illness. Who's crazy, right? It goes all the way back to Shakespeare and, where some of the wisdom comes from his madmen, yeah?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, this really looks like it must have been a great project to be working on, and work continues, I'm sure. Thanks so much, Alex.
No, thanks for having me.
Alex Monroe is the guest director of Peter Schaffer's Equus, which opens Thursday and runs until June 5th at Manoa Valley Theater. And details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Stephen Jenkinson, author of the book Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how dying might be a way of loving being alive after all.
Sunday morning at 11.
The next time you're on the road, check out the license plate frames for the vehicles around you. Can you spot one of Hawaii Public Radio's more than 4,000 sustaining members? We'd like to send a big mahalo to these supporters whose monthly contributions provide the station with a source of reliable income. Carlson Mun of Mililani, Jonathan Williams of Kaneohe, and Jack Durham of Honolulu. If you'd like to help HPR steer a stable course into the future, become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org or give us a call to find out more at 955-8821. A well-known Hawaii businessman is founder and chairman of a company which owns several properties along the rail route. He's also on the Hart board. So does Colbert Matsumoto have a conflict of interest? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so what happened to the idea that maybe the appearance of a conflict of interest is still a conflict of interest?
Well, that's the thing that's a question here, whether Matsumoto does have such a conflict. Let me just explain to you very briefly Nick Gruby, our reporter's scoop, a good one. So Matsumoto has a company called Tradewind Capital. He's a founder. He's a chair of that company. It's a real estate firm, and it has two properties in Kaka'ako, very near the rail route, purchased them just 5 days before Kirk Caldwell appointed Matsumoto to Hart. It also owns two parcels along Dillingham. That's also along the rail route near some rail stops. Of course, the potential for profit with what's known as TOD, transit-oriented development, is tremendous. And that is the concern, whether somehow Matsumoto might benefit financially from these ownings. He tells us, look, this is my company, not me, that owns these properties. But none of this information was disclosed when Matsumoto was named to the Hart board.
And that seems to be where the big rub is, that, you know, even if he were to have said, this is my company, this is what we've done, I mean, because clearly that sale was in work, and to be able to assure that he would not have voting maybe on those issues and recuse himself.
Right. We asked the mayor for a comment yesterday. His spokesman said that he's confident that Matsumoto will disclose and recuse himself whenever such a situation arises. But Nick also talked to a corporate law professor whose specialty is government ethics and says, you know, you really should avoid even the appearance of having a conflict, let alone not vote on these matters. By the way, Matsumoto is required to follow city ethics laws and file a financial disclosure form which reveals his business interest, but those are not public records. We asked to take a look at them. Matsumoto declined to provide that to us. He downplayed the ownership question. He said, in fact, he thinks his business experience as someone who is connected to a company with properties along rail might actually be beneficial in informing, you know, Hart members of his expertise, right? Sharing information about development and so forth. A unique perspective is what he called it. At the same time, Matsumoto is also saying he is talking with Hart attorneys to determine whether there are any conflicts and will inquire with the City Ethics Commission as well on this regard.
And the whole point seems to go back to whether or not we should have known that beforehand.
Right. He's a very connected man. He's executive chair of Island Insurance. He is a trustee of the Employees Retirement System. He's a director of Oahu Publications, which publishes the Honolulu Star Advertiser. And now that this rail project may be going as high as $8.1 billion, if you look at the federal estimates yesterday, there is a very serious concern about this. So we'll see how this all pans out. I'm certain our Nick Gruby will stay on it.
A very well-connected man, both of them. Thanks very much for the scoop.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Have a good weekend, because I won't see you for a while. And
oh, I wonder why.
Week, so we'll talk when I'm back on May 30th.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily for a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:34, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. If you want to be in touch, there are plenty of options. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, news analyst Neil Conan takes a look at this week's news, and later, Hawaii's new Shakespeare champ, Ari Dalbert. First, this news from Deutsche Welle.
Increasingly more of the Republican establishment is coming to accept that the party's all but certain nominee. Meanwhile, Democrats are continuing to fight, even though that party's nomination appears to be locked up as well. And voters in the Philippines elect a tough-talking populist who could shake up the strategic alignment in the South China Sea. Those are just some of the stories on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan this week. And he joins us now, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut farm on the Big Island. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So let's start with the Democrats this week. Now, primaries continue in both parties. Of course, there's just one candidate left on the Republican side. Democrats vote today in Oregon and Kentucky. And Bernie Sanders is expected to clean up pretty well in Oregon, but it looks like a different kind of contest in Kentucky.
It does. One small correction. All but a handful of votes have already been cast in Oregon.
True.
Elections there are conducted by mail. There is one strange poll there that shows Clinton up by 15 points, but nobody believes it. On demographics, Oregon looks good for Senator Sanders, with fewer of the African-Americans and Latinos have been such a big part of Secretary Clinton's base, and it's an open primary, so that allows in the independents who have largely supported Sanders.
In Kentucky, they have the old-fashioned voting booths, right? And people are just lining up to vote?
Absolutely. And you're also right that this one looks closer. At least we think so, because that's what the campaigns tell us. There's no opinion polls in Kentucky. Unlike Indiana and West Virginia earlier this month, and for that matter in Oregon, Secretary Clinton decided to compete in Kentucky. Her campaign spent heavily on TV there. Some say wasting valuable resources better spent against Donald Trump and the Republicans. But while she does not need a win in Kentucky, it's her best chance at a win this whole month. It's a closed primary, Democrats only. She's worked very hard there, especially the last few days, while Senator Sanders moved on to Puerto Rico and California.
Bernie Sanders says that he's going to be in it to win it, although the arithmetic clearly argues that's really not possible. Is he beginning to prepare his supporters for what looks like the inevitable?
No, I don't think so. And if you listen to the Sanders supporters on social media, the one state they are focused on this week is not Kentucky or Oregon. It's not even California. It's Nevada.
Hang on a second. Wait. Nevada, didn't they vote months ago? I mean, Clinton won that caucus back in February, yes?
That's absolutely right. But the statewide convention to select delegates to the national convention was held this past weekend. Enthusiastic Sanders supporters hoped they could pick up a delegate or two, or at least pack the delegation with Bernie boosters who might have to vote for Clinton on the presidential ballot but could support Sanders' initiatives on, you know, things like rules and procedures. A big block of Sanders people was ruled ineligible. And then it got ugly in Las Vegas. Absolute fury from some Sanders supporters and what they say, you know, is a system that's not only rigged against them, but that they were being treated with disrespect by people they call Clinton thugs. And people started throwing things to the hall. It all went online as well, of course. And the chair of the Nevada Democratic primary party got death threats by text. Her children were threatened. The convention was shut down before things got even further out of hand. And if that's what it's going to look like at the national convention in Philadelphia, it could be a debacle.
No kidding. Now, not so long ago, though, remember, it was the Republican convention that people were worrying about. I mean, Trump threatening that if he didn't get his way. But, you know, that fight is kind of over, even if a lot of prominent party leaders kind of won't be there either.
Can you imagine a national convention without the last, the only two living Republican presidents and without the two presidential candidates who followed them? The most recent of those, Mitt Romney, continues to agitate for a conservative alternative to a candidate he calls unqualified to be president. But the Never Trump movement is all but dead, and much of Washington and the party leadership has edged towards Donald Trump, however grudgingly.
Now, last week, Trump went to Washington for that very much anticipated meeting with the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. He came away not very much with an endorsement, at least not yet, but with a statement that sort of emphasized common ground. I mean, how good is that?
Well, you could practically hear Paul Ryan's teeth grinding. He disagrees with Trump on major policy issues, and maybe you could get past that for the sake of party unity, but I put him among those Republicans, like his running mate Mitt Romney, like both Presidents Bush, who deeply dislike Trump's crass manner, his bigotry, his threats to resort to violence, his inability to control his impulses. And these Republicans, not just Paul Ryan, but he's the most prominent, these Republicans have to be panicking that if they do manage to bring themselves to shake his hand and endorse him, that after that he's going to do something or some series of things that will deeply embarrass them and the Republican Party.
Okay, I got two words for you. John Miller.
That's right. That's the laughing stock of the week. Donald Trump calling reporters pretending to be a Trump spokesman named John Miller as a way to boast about himself. This was some years ago, though, you know, apparently long enough ago that Trump forgot that he'd admitted it.
I want to move on to another election, the one in the Philippines. Now, Rodrigo Duterte is the president-elect, and few have been able to resist the comparison to Donald Trump.
And most add immediately after that, Donald Trump on steroids. This is the long-running mayor of the southern city of Davao. He ran a populist campaign against what he called a rigged system. He made extremely crude jokes about women, even a rape joke. In his time as mayor, he endorsed rough justice against criminals. Hundreds of alleged gangsters were killed by police and vigilantes. He vowed that as president, he would fill Manila Bay with the corpses of criminals. He declared that he would suspend Congress and impose martial law if legislators refused to enact his program. And when asked, he did not shy away from the word dictator.
Are things in the Philippines, you know, really that bad, though? I mean, I thought this was supposed to be an economic success story.
On some levels, it has been. There's been 6.5% annual economic growth under President Aquino, and that is remarkable, especially in the Philippines, which has been very, you know, sort of described as the sick man of Asia in recent years. But that growth has not filtered down to, let's use the American terminology here, down to the 99%. Times are still very tough for most people. Crime is a major problem. Corruption is a major problem. And as we saw in this election, you know, complacency among the ruling elites, the top families that have sort of swapped the presidency back and forth since the restoration of democracy 30 years ago, well, that's a problem too.
Okay, but in terms of U.S. policy, you know, the Philippines is important as maybe the most outspoken of the countries opposing China's expansion, say, in the South China Sea.
Yeah, and in the Philippine context, that's the West Philippine Sea, if you please. In recent years, China pushed Filipino fishermen out of some of their traditional fishing grounds. It seized territory the Philippines regards as its national territory. And that sort of pushed the Philippines back into a military alliance with the United States. And the Philippines agreed to let its former colonial power come back in and use Philippine bases.
So how does the president-elect see all that?
Early days yet, but, you know, nationalist might be the word that fits the bill. He objects to Chinese aggression, but he may object even more to a wider American role in the Philippines. On this, Duterte calls himself a socialist, deeply skeptical of the United States. He's spoken about accommodating China, making a deal to go along with Chinese ambitions in the South China Sea in return for Chinese investment, which is clearly an opening for Beijing. We're going to have to see if they can take advantage of it.
All right, we got to leave it there. And as it happens, I'm going to be away next week, and so are you. So we will reconvene on the 31st. Deal?
Talk to you again in a couple of weeks, Beth Ann.
Thanks, Neil. And Neil Conan is our news analyst who joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:47. Now we're going to get back to today's backyard quiz. And this morning we asked you to tell us the name of an island in the Caribbean that shares a remarkable number of similarities with Hawaii. The island in question was named after an abbey in Barcelona by Christopher Columbus. Much like Hawaii, that island is volcanically active and had a destructive outcome in 1995. That year, the island's then dormant volcano came alive and largely destroyed the capital city of Plymouth. Heavy volcanic activity has continued to this day. The entire southern half of the island is evacuated and quarantined. Fortunately for residents, their island is an overseas territory of the United Kingdom, and many were able to relocate to the UK. If you haven't figured it out by now, we're referring to the island of Montserrat, which has a slightly different spelling but similar etymology as Montserrat Street in Honolulu. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, send it in. Or we have a winner? Nobody told me we had
Mr.
a winner.
Mr. Hess, well, I was saving it as a surprise.
Oh, I like surprises. That's a good one.
Mr. Hess of Poipu did, in fact, know that. He's the winner. He gets a HPR T-shirt.
Yay. Good for you. Thanks so much. Love it when we get a winner. And now at 8:48, that's the end of today's quiz. But again, if you've got one for us, send it in to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
There's a reason actors spend their entire careers interpreting Shakespeare and chart the course of their own lives by the roles they play, starting as Romeo, ending as King Lear. Shakespeare's work can be interpreted and reinterpreted endlessly, but the poetry falls flat unless it is understood, which makes young Ari Dalbert's accomplishment as the national winner of the 33rd Annual English-Speaking Union's National Shakespeare Competition all the more remarkable. Ari's with us this morning. Good morning, Ari.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
This consists of getting on stage, doing a cold reading, which you're given a few minutes to study before you get on stage, and then a memorized sonnet and a memorized soliloquy, those last two being your choices.
That's right, yeah.
So how did that go?
The cold reading is actually, there's the semifinals first, which is about 54 students, one from each branch of the ESU, and then the judges deliberate, and there's a top 10 that are picked, the finals, new set of judges, and then we have to perform our pieces again, and in addition, do the cold reading.
You got handed
Shylock.
Shylock.
Merchant of Venice, yeah. I was really lucky, yeah.
Lucky because you were familiar with the speech?
Yeah, yeah.
What is it that you need to be familiar with to really deliver in a case like that?
You obviously, when you're performing, you always have to know why your character is saying what he's saying. So just knowing the circumstances of the play, I think, is always very important, and that's why.
Which is accomplished how?
Through the text, but also just through the text. Often when you get a piece, it's very clear why the person's saying the things. But sometimes unless you know the intricacies of that character and his relationship to other characters. There's stuff hiding underneath of why he's saying, like, that he may be delivering something with irony, referring to something that happened before in the play.
Because so often, with just about any speech in Shakespeare, the inflection is dependent on the others on stage and his relationships with them.
Right,
yeah?
Of course. Yeah. So it's reacting. reacting to what others are saying is always more important than what you yourself are saying, for the most part.
Was that a tough lesson to take on in your development as an actor?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That goes hand in hand with not showing, you know? I think the most important thing is to never show an emotion, right?
Yeah.
Or be worried about how, or to not be looking at yourself, right, from the audience. Mm-hmm. It's just sharing. Yeah.
Which in a way, and I mean, there are parallels in other performing arts I can think of. It's almost as if you're relying on telepathy. If you feel something strongly enough, people are going to know you're feeling it.
Yeah.
Does it work that way for you?
And just the audience is so important. I mean, the audience is, especially in Shakespeare, where the characters very often directly address the audience. Without the audience, Shakespeare wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's so much about an interaction with the audience. Especially in these soliloquies, where more often than not.
Well, yeah, and in some of them, I'm thinking of Richard III, where he completely he pulls the curtain aside and says, here's what I'm about to do,
right?
Which rarely succeeds except in Shakespeare.
Yeah, Yeah.
You know, we were talking a minute ago, and you made an interesting point to me in terms of how Shakespeare is taught, which is kind of you're saying that you've really got to sort of walk the play, mm-hmm. that you can't just read the text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shakespeare wasn't meant to be read ever. It's a play. And I think a lot of times sitting down and just having to read it in a classroom and then analyze it and go back and can really turn a lot of people off from Shakespeare. Obviously, it's a difficult situation because it's still a classroom, and you need to be able to grade and stuff. But I think going forward, if there's a way to sort of explore how to get people up on their feet and saying the words, because often understanding the words comes through that. Like, you make discoveries while you're saying the words
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that you can't make when you're reading it.
In some ways, those discoveries even sort of determined by the rhythms of the speech,
exactly.
by the patterns.
Yeah,
sort
the
of
pentameter
leads.
Is so, it's interesting. The pentameter is there to help memorize, because the actors back in those days would get three plays and they would have a week to memorize three plays. And so the pentameter really helps you. I mean, obviously you have to know when you can break away from that, right?
Yeah.
Especially now, today, if you don't want to alienate your audience, but the rhythm, often you'll hear someone deviate from the rhythm, and then not on that line, but two or three lines later, they'll go up on their lines and forget.
Right.
Because it really, it leads you. It's there for a reason.
That's what rhythm's for, right? Hey, we've got just enough time for a sonnet. Are you up for it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is Sonnet 55. Not marble, nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme. But you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time. When wasteful war shall statues overturn and broils root out the work of masonry, nor Mars his sword, nor war's quick fire shall burn the living record of your memory. Against death and all oblivious enmity shall you pace forth. Your praise shall still find room, even in the eyes of all posterity that wear this world out to the ending doom. So, till the judgment that yourself arise, you live in this and dwell in lovers' eyes.
You know, he makes his argument so clearly and conveys such a florid message in language that you just can't. It just carries you along, doesn't it?
The thoughts are there, you know.
Yeah.
They're on the page.
They sure are. Yeah. Thanks so much, Ari.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ari Daubert is a homeschooled junior and actor who was born in Switzerland, grew up in Makaha. He's the winner of the 33rd Annual English-Speaking Union National Shakespeare Competition, which took place on May 2nd at Lincoln Center in New York City.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
The friendly rivalries between Scandinavians can sometimes result in a bad joke.
Do you know why the National Library has been closed in Oslo? Because somebody stole the book.
Find out what happens when a Swede and a Norwegian walk into a bar. Get an overview of Australia's urbanized East Coast and take a cross-country road trip with the kids.
I think our message is that anyone can do this.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
Now you got to be a little brave to go traveling with the kids, but it's a great experience.
That's right.
I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks.
So I hear.
So you hear, yeah. But I know all good things will carry on here, and I know tomorrow you're going to be speaking with Dr. Rhett Butler, lead researcher on the recently published study of the likelihood of the potential implications of a powerful tsunami hitting Hawaii.
And Dominic D'Andrea, founder and producing artistic director of Kumukuhua's second annual one-minute play festival.
If you'd like to be in touch, there are lots of ways you can do that. You can call our talkback line anytime you like, And leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Or if you like email, you can try that at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. We tweet at HI Conversation, or you can get to me, well, maybe not in the next couple of weeks, but you can, at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
Well, I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Chris will see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.